Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Hi, this is not Goldie from WNED, but hey, I'll do my best. This is fundraising week at CFMU, and we're trying to raise up to $21,000. Hey, we'd like to have more for our virtual server and for other things we need at the station to keep the good programming coming out to you. This week's a little bit different. Now, you know I pre-record my show, but this week I'm at the station playing the pre-recorded show and available for your calls. 528-9888. We're going to show you a few different things, some past shows, triumphs from past shows. We're going to even share some news from past shows that actually didn't make it on the air but should have. And if in the past or even today you find you share our enthusiasm for community radio, its representation of minority groups, alternate points of view, alternate music, sure, there's a lot of alternate music, why don't you go to our website, www.cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. At the website, you'll find a PayPal banner. You can click on it and you can use your PayPal account or your credit card to make a donation to CFMU. $30 gets you a minimum donation for the CFMU Friends program, our new program offering special privileges at merchants around the city for showing your CFMU card. Now let's kick off today's show on a mellow note, Conversation on the number 118.
Conversation from the number 118. She jumped up the steps of the number 118 Herdman Station bus at the middle doors, shouting simultaneously to the bus driver at the front. "Do you stop at Herdman Station?" She repeated herself loudly when there was no instant reply. Finally, the driver shouted back an affirmative reply. Relieved, she half fell, half threw herself into the seat next to me. The bus lunged onward. Her eyes were bright blue like summer cornflowers. Her light-colored hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Trails of honey strands framed her face. Panicking, she suddenly began searching the bus floor. "Did I drop something?" By this time, every passenger in the vicinity of our seat was involved in this young girl's plight. Everyone anxious to get her settled so they could resume reading or daydreaming. The passengers said no emphatically. She bowed her head down toward her chest and, slightly raising her face, said rather slowly and matter-of-factly to whomever was still listening, "I'm having a bad day." I felt a surreal experience coming on, and my fate was sealed. As I was the passenger sitting next to her, she began to engage me in a very honest, brutally sensitive conversation. "My mother calls me retarded, and my brothers call me retarded too. I wish they wouldn't call me that." There was a very dramatic pause. One could hear the feet of some of the passengers shuffling uncomfortably and papers shaking with discomfort. She turned her head and stared directly at me with all the intensity of her innocence. Then she fired the loaded question my way. "Do you think I'm retarded?" I searched inside myself and felt helpless. I looked back at her and decided that the only way to converse with this engaging young person was eye to eye and heart to heart. "No," I firmly said, as I looked at her, and I meant it, because long ago I had discarded such demeaning attempt to box people in a negative category. Then I added a cliche that I thought would be a segue out of the silence that followed my reply. "Everyone is unique. We all have our gifts, and you have your gifts too." She was fully capable of understanding this idea, and to my relief, completed my thought by adding, "Yes, and nobody's perfect. But my mother says I can't get married because I'm retarded," she added. I replied that that wasn't necessarily true. When the right person and with loving support, it can happen. In the back of my mind, a secondary analysis was occurring, as I wondered what kind of mother would say such negative things to a daughter who was courageously trying to find her own place in the world. A daughter obviously dealing with emotional abuse. She lamented that her brothers call a friend with Down syndrome retarded. "He is my friend, and he is not a retard either," she loudly complained. She called to a smiling young man sitting across the aisle. "Hi, Michael. You're my friend, and you don't think I'm retarded either, do you?" I wish I could change families. "Well," I stated the facts blandly, "we are born into a family, but we can choose our friends." In an attempt to comfort her about her siblings' teasing, I said, "Maybe when your brothers are a little older, they won't tease you." I surmised they must be younger than her and thoughtless. I recklessly steered the conversation in the wrong direction when I asked, "How old are your brothers?" "Oh, 29 and 27, she replied. I mentally froze and remembered reading about 6-year-old Jeffrey Baldwin, who starved to death with 6 other adults in the house, privy to the dire circumstances and the horror of his isolation. Of course, his was an extreme situation. All the same, abuse is abuse is abuse. It was like she read my mind, because she then said, "I hate going home every day. I like going to work. I never have a bad day at work. I work at the food bank 5 days a week, every afternoon for 2 hours. I like the work, but it's not enough time." "Well," I replied, "it's really good you have that, and maybe one day your brothers will treat you better." After a minute of silence, she stared at me again. "I wish I could be in your family." I felt complimented, but at a loss. The bus suddenly tipped to the left, the familiar clue that we were approaching Herdman Station. With the same impetuous energy with which she alighted on the bus, she jumped up. "Can I buy you a coffee?" she asked. "Well, I am on my way home," I replied. "I can't stop today. Maybe another day." Then she completely blew me away, as she intently looked at me and softly asked, "Are you going to worry about me?" My first inclination was to respond yes, as deep inside I wanted to mother her and change her situation. But instead, I gave an answer that hopefully would plant a thought that could take root and grow. "No," I replied firmly, to calm my own apprehension, "because I know that you can take care of yourself." She peered deeply into my eyes. The answer seemed to please her, because her face lit up in a gigantic smile. The bus doors opened, and she was gone.
Did you know that CFMU is 33 years old and is one of the 3 oldest campus radio stations in Canada, along with Ottawa and Kingston's community and campus radio? CFRU in Guelph is also at 93.3 FM. They're only a couple years younger than us. We've got 150 volunteers at least, and we have programming that's been syndicated to other stations. Every year we receive pledges from all over the country and the world for our fundraising drive. 15 different cultural communities have a voice on CFMU. Some of our shows have been on the air for a decade or more. Breakfast of Champions began before we even went FM in 1978. In 2010, CFMU was awarded Station of the Year at the 2010 Hamilton Music Awards. We've also received 4 other nominations. We've won Station of the Year in 2004, 2005, and 2007 as well. In 1998, we were awarded Campus Station of the Year at the Canadian Music Reek Awards. Now, we're a campus and community station. That means we're equal parts staffed by volunteers from the campus at McMaster and from the greater Hamilton community. Anybody can apply to be a host here, and we have teenagers and we have seniors hosting shows on the station. All the volunteers are trained right here at CFMU, and most begin with no radio experience whatsoever. We provide training and experience to young people every year through our co-op program. We're also one of the few radio co-op programs that allows our students to get real hands-on on-air experience. And if that sounds worthwhile to you, make a donation. $20 will get you a CD, and no, $40 won't get you two, but we'll thank you with a CD, and you can choose your CD from a list that we have at the call-in desk. $60 will get you a CD and a T-shirt, CFMU Raise Your Voice T-shirt, and all of our donation options come packaged with the Long & McQuaid gift card. If you want to draw a middle ground with your donation, we're willing to help you too. $30 gets you that Friends of CFMU gift card that gives you perks at different restaurants and merchants around the city of Hamilton, and that's a list that will only grow. Now, I mentioned we deal with past show triumphs. Here's a triumph that we didn't air. It came to us surreptitiously. We were interviewing for months and months and months Carter Baluni in Montreal, isolated in a church in sanctuary because he couldn't get his Canadian refugee status. Before one of our last interviews, Carter spoke to me quite confidentially and told me that he had friends in the federal government and that he'd been told that if we would just stop airing his conversations on the show, that he would get his refugee status and papers. So we gladly agreed to do that. And without any accusations or allusions, we dropped Carter Baluni's interview. We didn't get any queries from the audience. About 6 months later, it hit the newspapers. We missed it. Carter told us about it. He got his immigration status. So that way, at least, we know the feds are listening to our show. Now we'll give you an example of a triumph from a past show where the provincial government is caught by a Conservative MPP when a guest on our show was stalled in a Lindsay hospital, couldn't get a place because he was too disabled to look for one, and the hospital was threatening to either put him in palliative care, which really are people who are dying, or throw him out. And the MPP got him a place when she heard that we were interviewing him and told the hospital. Well, Brian, glad to have you on the show. I know you're going to be spending Christmas in the hospital, but you have some good news.
Oh, yeah, I finally found a place to move into January the 2nd.
You could almost say the place found you.
Yeah, well, actually it did. We had run an ad in the local rag, and a woman at the Affies, 7 minutes away from the hospital, phoned, and she had a bed sitting room in the front room of her farmhouse, which is over 100 years old.
Yep.
Available. It includes room and board, and it's a hobby farm. They have cows and chickens and pigs and a couple of disabled daughters, so the bathroom is handicap accessible, and the laundry room's on the main floor, and the kitchen's on the main floor, and they have a ramp up in the front door.
That's not bad.
Right by my room, so
yeah.
It turns out to be a win-win situation because I can help with the household chores and stuff like that.
Oh, good. And I understand it's room and board, which meets your needs pretty well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Wonderful. Well, I've been in the hospital for almost 7, but I was actively looking for a place to move to for almost 4 months.
Yeah.
The accommodation problem didn't start until really the end of August. Well, I guess it was 2 months I was okay. And then the place I was going to move into fell through because the woman got sick.
That's right.
Well, that's, you know, that can happen. So.
Yeah.
But there should be some sort of government-run or sponsored registry for people to register their homes or their apartments or whatever, who can take in roommates or boarders or whatever.
Yeah.
And to go through all this crapola of finding a place.
Yeah.
Especially for those who are handicapped or disabled, what do you want to call it? Be it mentally or physically, doesn't matter.
Given the attitudinal problems that seem to prevail with the people who manage municipal housing across the province, I'm not attacking a few individuals. In my experience, I have yet to meet a housing facility that's free of attitude towards the people who need housing. It's a powerful position, and the temptation must be quite strong to flex that power a little bit. It might be better even if it wasn't government run, if it were set up by some dispassionate
NGO.
Yeah, some dispassionate NGO who aren't beholden to anyone in particular for funding and don't have a political axe to grind as a result.
Yeah.
I'm daydreaming now, but man,
well,
that would be nice.
Nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely would be.
Yeah. What do you think caused the problems that you had? Now, recall that I approached almost all the housing providers, and all I got word of was an unwillingness to literally communicate with you two ways. I don't think anybody I called you back, did they?
No.
No. And I called politicians, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I called the mayor, I called the local MPP. We were on the verge of calling the housing minister when you broke through.
Right. I have no idea. I think it's a combination of these other agendas out there. They're hidden agendas. They have to have so many places for accommodation for abused women. I'm not trying to pick on women, but there are other priorities out there besides abused women.
Well, woman abuse hasn't shrunken, and unfortunately the housing supply has remained static. So as one of the people that I interviewed remarked, it's getting close to the point where we'll be lucky to supply abused women with subsidy housing, let alone anybody else. They're caught in the middle between a government that won't provide housing and a growing army of people who need it.
And the other thing, too, this snap federal election, that's messed up Paul Martin's promise to give cash grants to landlords to reduce their rents for affordable housing.
Right.
And that's never come on. That's still a good idea.
Right.
Because even here in Lindsay, a one-bedroom apartment in an apartment building costs at minimum $700 a month.
Sounds like Burlington.
Well, and if you're making $860 on Canada Pension Disability or OGST,
yeah,
you can't do it.
No.
Now, why are people who are disabled, why can't they have proper private accommodations if they so choose? Now, maybe some people want to live in a group home or have a roommate.
Yeah.
Or take room and board. I prefer to be in my own small apartment, even if it was just a bachelor apartment, but I can't afford it.
Yeah.
Those opportunities just don't hurt that. A place like Habitat for Humanity, that's a fantastic idea. But there's not enough of it, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, once a person gets in their own home, they've got to maintain it.
Yeah.
Why can't there be something like Habitat for Humanity that covers running the house? For seniors, that's a good idea because they have a low cost for seniors who need help in their home.
I was sort of lying awake thinking about it because as someone listening may have figured out, and I probably told you, I'm looking for housing too. And I think one of the biggest problems is the divide the Conservatives created between municipal administration and provincial income levels. So the province sets the income and says, okay, here's the income, go and find your housing. You say, well, I can't afford to find housing. The province says, housing's not our portfolio anymore. So you go to the housing people and you say, I don't get enough income. And they say, well, what do you want us to do? We're the town. The income isn't our portfolio. People on fixed incomes, their health is being used as capital to fund other tax expenditures.
Yeah.
And they're getting away with it at the provincial level because they say that housing isn't their business. Now, at the municipal level, it's more complicated than that because at the municipal level, they say, well, it's our job to house the people in our community. So if you think you might want to move to a different community to access another opportunity, whether it's schooling or it's work, they have a list that's supposed to be equitable for everybody who wants housing, but believe me, if you're from out of town, you won't get anywhere on that list.
Even people who are working full-time at a minimum wage job of $7.75 an hour must find it awfully hard to make ends meet.
I think they do.
Subsidized housing or low-cost housing. The government has to provide it from a social conscience point of view.
Yeah.
And the only way to make them responsible for that social conscience is the electorate has to say, hey, this must be number one issue or number three issue, not the bottom of the pile.
It's a great note to end on. Brian, I'm afraid this is going to be the last conversation we have about your housing because your problem is solved. I'm sorry you have to spend Christmas in the hospital, but it's 10 Angeline Street North in Lindsay, Ross Memorial Hospital. And I'm glad you're going to start the new year off in a new place of your own. And I think I'm going to follow your example. I'm going to put an ad in the paper, and I recommend the same to anybody listening.
Sure, go for it.
All right.
Some of the community papers even take them for free.
Wow.
So,
wow.
It might work.
What a thought.
Yeah. Well, you have a happy holiday, your mom and your family.
Thanks. Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year, you and Steve.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now we'll move on to a housing commentator who remarks on why people find it difficult to switch housing when the housing they are in, their disability's gotten worse, or they have developed an environmental sensitivity, or the apartment has deteriorated to the point where it's no longer healthy to live in, why they can't just swap it for another subsidized apartment. But before we do, if you are a longtime listener to CFMU, you know we're different than commercial radio. I'm going to give you a few indicators of how different CFMU is before we ask for your donation again. CFMU's programming schedule is almost 100% station produced. That means almost all our programming is made by people in the community. CFMU is the official station for emergency broadcast information in Hamilton as part of an initiative involving the station, City Hall, and C101.5. FM at Mohawk College. CFMU's website, http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca, features instant streaming, community events, playlist features, show features, downloadable and streamable archives, and more. CFMU has a voice in Hamilton's anti-racist media group, the Hamilton Media Advisory Council. CFMU's program director has been co-chair and chair of this committee in the past. CFMU is actively involved in the creation of Super Crawl, an amazing event that debuted September 2009 and featured an on-site simulcast with Indy FM. If this sounds good to you, give us a call, 528-9888, or go to the website, cfmu.mcmaster.ca, and look for the PayPal donor button. And send us your best. Now, Ernie Lightman and his revelation regarding subsidy housing in Ontario.
Disrespect welcomes to the show today Professor Ernie Lightman from University of Toronto to talk to us about housing. Dr. Lightman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You raised the question of the validity of a chronological fallback for the waiting list at all. I mean, a lot of people on the list and they don't have priorities, they're just going to stay there.
That's absolutely right. If you're not near the top of the list, your chances of ever getting on are minimal because there are other groups that are priorities. They're always going to jump to the head of the queue, and if it means that you're never going to get too far up the list. That's why the waiting list is so long.
Cities have tasked the managers of waiting lists with keeping them as short as possible, and yet there is no priority for transfer. In other words, somebody who's giving up a subsidy apartment for a different one for a reason. Can't exchange apartments. They go to the bottom of the waiting list and wait another 13 years before they get their transfer. Somebody who is transferring from a co-op to a municipal nonprofit goes to the bottom of the waiting list and waits another 12 or 13 years. How did it come to be that we, as the people who support the government, task managers with keeping the waiting list short and managing it efficiently and putting these horrific roadblocks in the way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know the answer, but the cynic in me, the cynic in me would say that not allowing people to transfer is a way of making sure they understand that they are dependents upon the state. That it's a way of keeping them powerless,
okay,
and keeping them deferential and keeping them in the status of dependence. In earlier years, when there was a huge amount of council housing in England, people used to regularly swap apartments.
Really.
And they were allowed to do that, and, you know, somebody would decide they want to go live somewhere else, and they'd find somebody and they'd trade. And there was always very bad press around it, on, like the press of the right, because it said, you know, these people are dependents. They are living in public housing. What gives them the right to move around like they own the houses? We are giving them something out of the goodness of our hearts, and they should bloody well be grateful and appreciative and not challenge and not question. And I have a feeling that that mentality might be there.
Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, had a quote, "I love to sail on treacherous seas and land on barbarous coasts." That's a good description of us at Disrespect. We live for revelations like the last one. The truth comes out on the show. How did we get into this? Well, if you've heard the fundraising show before, you've probably heard how, but if you haven't, I had become disabled. I lost the willingness to do what I had done that brought me to disability. I asked a friend if I could read on his radio show, and I told him I wasn't interested in the news. I was just interested in reading. And he said, "Well, yeah, I've got lots of news and I can't often make it into the show. Why don't you go in and read it?" So there were a group of people on the show who read. It was called Revolt Radio. And I went in and read my news until one day his partner, who also co-founded the show, asked me, "Where's your news?" And I told him, "That's not the deal. I don't bring news. I just read." And he said, "Well, what do you know?" And I kind of resented this persistence. And I thought, I'll set him back on his haunches. "I know about disability," I said. And he said, "Good." He said, "Then you can bring the disability news." Well, I didn't know there was such a thing as disability news, and I suspect he didn't either. But I looked into it, and in the U.S., at least on the web, there was disability news. People were trying to make a living off it. They weren't doing very well. Nevertheless, many of them were dedicated, and many of them were instrumental in encouraging social progress. So I adopted his mandate to do the disability news, and that summer, with all our students gone for 2 months, I started doing little 10-minute interviews. And in the fall, I took the leap and turned it into a half-hour show. Now it's a one-hour show that you enjoy here. I hope you will back that show up with your support. And call us, 528-9888, or go to the website, cfmu.mcmaster.ca, click on the PayPal button, and make a donation.
The net gain for people on fixed incomes is about 0.2%.
That's through 2003. Now, if we go into 2004, that's probably disappeared.
You mean it's a zero, or less?
Probably by this point.
So it includes the McGinty increase?
Yeah.
Okay. And it dates back to when? What period are you accounting for here in the 0.2%?
We're talking about the increase from 2002 to 2003.
Okay.
Which was an increase of minus 2.8%. So he increased 3% in 2004, which means it's a net increase of 0.2%.
In the 1 year?
As of 2003.
Right.
But the increase occurred in 2004. That 0.2% is probably wiped out by now.
Okay. And it looks like this is worse for single-parent families.
Single-parent families, if you have a single-parent family with one child,
right,
then in the 2002 to 2003, they lost 3.8%, so the 3% increase is really a loss of 0.8%.
Okay.
If you're dealing with a couple and two children, so that if they get 3% now, it's a loss of 0.8%. Couple and two children, between those 2 years, it's a loss of 4.4%.
Oh, my goodness.
In every respect, people are worse off after the supposed 3% increase than they were before.
And you put this down to, at the end of the article, to a hostility toward welfare recipients. It appears almost a hostility toward single parents.
Oh, definitely. Single parents are walking Rorschach tests. There's a tendency to blame them for all kinds of things. Just think of Mike Harris's comment about pregnant, beer-swilling women. There's this kind of attitude towards single parents.
Where does it come from?
In one of the articles that I had in The Social Edge, I traced it to what I think is a psychological factor, which is that people need to project their forbidden sexual desires onto somebody else.
Right.
These single parents are an important target for this sort of thing. As I said, they're walking Rorschach tests. People look at them and project all of their negative feelings onto these unfortunate persons.
So the fact that they're unattached
and have children
almost makes them targets for a kind of stalking.
There must be something evil about such people who do things that I would like to do but don't dare. They're getting away with something that I can't do.
Okay. Be it having fun or having a family or whatever.
Having fun, having sex. And so that's what's happening.
I have a single parent associate who is affiliated with the show who would probably dispute the accusation that she's having too much fun. She has two kids, and it's a big commitment, but it's interesting that you would draw that out.
It's not a matter of she is in fact having fun.
No.
It's a matter of this is...
Just the perception.
This is what is going on inside certain ids, such as that of Mike Harris.
Right.
It's our perception that very little has changed since the days of Mike Harris. The difference is we had a bully in office until 2003, something like that. And for two terms, we've had a passive aggressive in office. Before we get to the news, though, let's give you a little break. Albert Ammons, Suitcase Blues.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. Before I review the news, I want to thank the merchants who donated food to our fundraising drive, for all the volunteers who were here over the week of the fundraiser. First, to the few who didn't want to be identified, our heartfelt thanks. Our warmest thanks to Denninger's Limited in Hamilton for the excellent sausages they've given us. For the second time, I'm afraid, on short notice, we thank you. And the managers of the grocery stores who've offered us food for our fundraiser. Some of them have been going for 7-8 years with this, maybe longer. Joe Jeffrey, manager at the Rosedale Metro. Mike Lavelle, manager at the University Plaza Metro. Sam Marchese, manager of Dundurn Fortino's. And to the donors who helped us out last year and who we're still trying to get in touch with this year, Lucy Kaluri at Main West Fortino's, Bill McDonald, Governor's Road Metro, and Jason Zielinski at the Fortino's at 1550 Upper James at Rymel. Thank you to all of you for supporting CFMU. You're a symbol of the support we get from the community that enables us to continue. And to remind you once again, these aren't newspaper articles that we read to you. These are abbreviations of the articles that you can find in the papers that we mention in the broadcast. First up on my news anyway, welfare diet cash crackdown. Province's new rules designed to stop fraud. New rules coming into effect April 1st will make it harder for welfare recipients to access public funding for food. The newly strengthened regulations meant to crack down on widespread fraud under the province's special diet allowance will affect the 165,000 Ontario residents currently living on disability or welfare who benefit from the allowance due to health issues. The new rules follow a 2009 report from the Auditor General that said fraudulent claims against the allowance valued at $67 million were partially responsible for a massive increase from 8,085 people accessing the fund in 2001. The Ontario government announced in December it would keep the special diet allowance but said it would tighten the rules involved with accessing the allowance, which pays up to $250 per month per recipient. The allowance gives extra money for the purchase of healthy food to recipients with health conditions such as diabetes or high blood pressure. Current recipients will have to reapply with a signature from a doctor, registered nurse, nutritionist, or midwife and get a government check of medical records. I hope your social worker has got a medical degree. That by Brett Bobblehead. Oh, I'm sorry, Brett Popplewell, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. How about a crackdown on hypocrisy? Welfare diet crash crackdown. Cash crackdown, February 27th. I, for one, would like to see a crackdown on the hypocrisy perpetrated by this government with respect to welfare basic and special allowances. Before they were elected, the Liberals decried the draconian measures implemented by the Conservatives in cuts to welfare allowances and eligibility. Successive ministers have done little enough to repair the damage, promising only to review the program. All levels of government express concerns about the health and diets of Canadians. They spend large amounts of money to promote drastic changes in habits, regulate nutrition information in restaurants and on food packaging, set limits to the use of certain ingredients and additives to processed and prepared foods, and advertise the health benefits of eating fresh, healthy food. They warn that without such changes, our medical system and budgets will be overwhelmed by patients with preventable diseases. There are three things the government needs to consider with respect to the integrity of its welfare program. The first is that income is the major predictor of health and medical outcomes, starting with prenatal care. The second is that basic welfare allowances for both food and shelter are woefully inadequate and bear no resemblance to rising real costs. The third is that chronically dehumanizing and criminalizing the poorest and most vulnerable citizens, overwhelmingly the sick, the old, the young, the disabled, the unemployed, perpetuates a mentality that they are the cause, not the victims, of our social problems. It is shameful. And that letter to the editor by Helga Steyer, Toronto, in the Toronto Star. Terminally ill baby's dad meets with his lawyer, Toronto. A southwestern Ontario man who's been fighting for months to bring his terminally ill baby home to die met with his Toronto lawyer. Mo miraculously met with lawyer Mark Handelman in Toronto to discuss his 13-month-old son, Joseph, who's on a ventilator at Victoria Hospital in London. Handelman says his focus remains on keeping the case out of court and finding a resolution. London doctors have refused the Windsor family's request to perform a tracheotomy on the baby, saying he's in a vegetative state with no hope of recovery. The family fears Joseph would suffer a painful choking death if his breathing tube is removed and want him to live out his remaining days at home. And that thanks to Canadian Press and The Spectator. From the ICU to the PR department, a new meaning of viral changes a hospital's battle. One of Canada's most prestigious medical institutions has made the bold decision to go public with details of a highly emotional tug-of-war over a dying infant in an attempt to defend itself against a slew of threats, condemnations, and criticisms playing out in social media. Social media is a major influence on public perception, said Matt Wilcox, a crisis communications consultant. Perception does become reality. London Health Sciences Centre decided on the weekend to launch a public information campaign about a dying infant in its care, Joseph Miraculously, after the case went viral. Videos have sprung up online that supporters say contradict the doctor's diagnosis that the baby is in a vegetative state. Petitions and campaigns have started in a bid to save Joseph's life. A website, SaveBabyJoseph.com, is asking for donations to help the family, and a similarly named Facebook page had swelled to nearly 13,300 members by Tuesday afternoon. Attention to the case by Fox News in the United States and conservative and anti-abortion websites sparked an overwhelming reaction, with some people condemning the hospital and Canada's healthcare system, while others have suggested the hospital is interfering with Joseph's treatment or that a death panel has ordered the baby to be killed. The hospital increased security after threats from people in Canada and the United States and is considering legal action against those who make defamatory comments. Officials declined to describe the threats. Said Udo Schuklenk, a medical ethics expert at Queen's University, they are very well within their right to do that. And in fact, I think it's a good thing, because otherwise this hospital would be in the conservative propaganda machine. They would be seen as the baby-killing hospital, and they're absolutely right to defend their reputation. Disrespect has another view of this situation. However, the people dealing with it are too busy to come on air at this time. We will have information on it in the next show or two. That article by Carly Weeks, Wednesday, March the 2nd, in the Globe and Mail. Ashley Smith inquest won't see stark video. Lawyers challenge coroner's decision. Prison video showing a teen inmate forcefully injected with tranquilizers while strapped to a stretcher for hours will not be shown to an inquest jury, say lawyers who are challenging an Ontario coroner's decision to exclude what they regard as key evidence. Dr. Bonita Porter's decision not to obtain proof of the abusive treatment of Ashley Smith only 90 days before she died in a jail cell runs completely afoul of the fundamental purpose of an inquest to be a public process, said lawyer Julian Faulkner for the teen's family. The inquest, set to begin April 4th in Toronto, has been called to probe the young woman's death and make recommendations to prevent similar deaths. Smith choked herself to death in 2007 at Grand Valley Institution for Women while correctional officers watched. Convinced she was just looking for attention, prison managers ordered staff not to enter her cell because she appeared to be breathing. Lawyers are challenging the coroner's decision. Their recent request for a public hearing to argue the matter was rejected. They have submitted written arguments Tuesday. We're right back at square one, said Faulkner. The coroner initially ruled the inquest would only consider the time Smith spent in Ontario. Lawyers argued that curtailing the inquest to this period of time would overlook key circumstances that led to her death. Porter agreed, and last fall expanded the inquest to include Smith's entire time in custody. A spokesperson for the coroner office told the Star Porter was unable to respond today. And as you might gather, that's from the Toronto Star, Diana Zlomislik, staff reporter. Report calls for public inquiry into shocking abuses at the G20. A full-scale public inquiry is needed in light of the widespread and violent trampling of civil rights by police at last summer's $1 billion G20 summit in Toronto, a new report concludes. The call for an inquiry is among recommendations in the report by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and National Union of Public and General Employees, which is aimed at holding governments accountable and avoiding a recurrence. The many violations of civil liberties that occurred during the summit, such as illegal detentions and searches and excessive uses of force, cannot have simply been the actions of a few bad apples, the report states. Rather, given the scope and severity of the violations of rights that occurred during the G20, it is difficult to view this situation as anything other than a failure of policy and training. Over and over again, witnesses recounted their experiences involving the excessive violent dispersal of peaceful demonstrators by police and the dehumanizing treatment of many of those who were detained. The vast majority of those detained or charged have been released, although a handful of cases are still before the courts. And that from the Canadian Press byline Colin Perkle in the Globe and Mail. McGuinty rejects call for G20 public inquiry. Ontario's Liberal government has flatly rejected calls for a full-scale public inquiry into police actions during the G20 summit in Toronto last June. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association called for the inquiry on Monday after releasing a report on its own public hearings into the G20, which found many instances of police violently trampling the civil rights of peaceful protesters. Even though the government secretly passed the law governing police powers during the G20, Premier Dalton McGuinty again dismissed the idea of holding a full public inquiry into police behavior. With five separate reviews that are underway, I think we are coming at it from a number of different perspectives, he said. Ontario's ombudsman condemned the police actions in a special report on the G20 summit, saying Toronto was under virtual martial law during the summit. The police actions are also being investigated by the Toronto Police Services Board, the Office of Independent Police Review Director, and the RCMP. Many photographs and videotapes have emerged since the G20 showing police officers, some with their name tags removed, beating protesters, which have led to charges against some officers. McGuinty acknowledged he had seen some of the videos, but he declined to offer an opinion on what he'd seen. The Premier also declined to say if it was appropriate for police to arrest people at Queen's Park, where he personally had invited them to protest during the G20 in a so-called free speech zone. And that from the Canadian Press, again in the Globe and Mail. And in what passes for good news on our newscast this week, Halton told to fix special needs backlog. Halton's public school board must treat its special education students fairly and fix its two-year waitlist for assessment, says Ontario's education minister. The issues raised in a Toronto Star article showing gifted students are being assessed while their autistic and learning disabled peers wait for testing and support are troubling, Leona Dombrowski said. Obviously, there are families who feel that the board is not responding adequately to the special education needs of children, she said, adding that Halton's trustees must act. We believe that all students, regardless of their exceptionality, should be treated fairly. The Star has outlined the situation of parents like Allison McDade, whose son Joe waited 13 months before an assessment for his learning disability began. Son Sam, 13, is still waiting. Sylvia Jones, opposition critic for Children and Youth Services, raised the issue in the legislature after reading about the McDades. The wait list can be as high as 2 years already, and yet trustees in Halton have acknowledged this change is going to push children who need special education supports in the classroom back to the back of the line again, she said. She later told the Star the wait list was worrisome and urged the board to deal with the holdups. The school board has since promised to table a report looking at ways to reduce wait times at a meeting. That will include measures to find ways to process psychological assessments so that the wait list is reduced, said Education Director David Uwali. When asked if those measures would mean the board directed extra money to special needs assessments or hired more psychoeducational consultants, he said, both. McDade said she hopes the board will hire more consultants and pay them to work over March break in the summer. I hope that they also put a stop to expanding the primary gifted program until this backlog is caught up. And that's all the news we have for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. There will be more. And now a reminder, this is our last bid for your support in this hour at CFMU 93.3 FM. You are the endorsement that allows our station to continue. Your support is the support we need to demonstrate to the community and the students who fund a large part of our bills that we are relevant, that we are in demand, that you do want us, and that you appreciate what we have to say and play. CFMU 93.3 is redefining radio in your community. That's our motto. We use that phrase because it reinforces our relevance and reflects a commitment to our mandate. We address issues across the local map in ways that satellite and mainstream radio cannot, reaching a broad audience more directly than internet radio alone. CFMU is a public meeting place for many voiceless dimensions in our society. Local cutting-edge artists and musicians, marginalized groups, multicultural families, and people with a keen social conscience. On over 24 programs, our dedicated volunteers freely express important ethnic questions, target news and culture in the community, expose new music to fresh ears, and welcome everyone to get involved. Big media is a different animal. They're not able to focus on burning issues in other languages the way that community radio can and does. For music and arts, CFMU provides an outlet for those outside the mainstream. Avant-garde artists, local musicians, artists in underrepresented genres. These artists will drive art in all its forms forward into the future. If this sounds like a mandate that you can get behind, go to our website, cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Look for the PayPal button, press it. Use your own PayPal account or your credit card to make a donation to CFMU. Remember, all of our donations include the draw for the Long & McQuaid gift card if you're a musician or interested in music. Our broadcasts stand independent of corporations, sponsors, advertisers, and political agendas. We originate from an intellectual community and do not ask people to park their opinions outside. CFMU is comfortable with risky subjects that need attention. Leadership in today's issues and tomorrow's art is our job. The unique language and the diverse attitude is our strength. CFMU is in some cases the only voice for some groups: the disabled, the embattled, gays and lesbians, Aboriginals, and socially conscious. Mainstream radio stations are companies doing business. Serving smaller niches can be difficult for them. We, however, are able to welcome these viewpoints. We unite these smaller, diverse communities into the bigger picture that is the thriving Hamilton community. Independent-minded volunteer programming deserves the support of our community. We are listener-supported radio. We serve our immediate community. Our voice is your voice. A stronger CFMU is a stronger voice for all of us. We need more community support, funds for operating costs, and reinforcement of our mission, so please go to the PayPal button on the cfmu.mcmaster.ca website and make a donation in support of your community radio. Or call us up, 528-9888. Someone who answers the phone will take your pledge. And now a lively piece, Memphis Slim, just playing Boogie Woogie. Thank you. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.